Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group and George Mason University School of Law's Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property, was recorded on Thursday, June 11, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on assessing the new administrative procedures for challenging patents. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome a whole group of experts, but to introduce the topic and to tell us more about the experts individually, we have our moderator for the call, Professor Mark Schultz, who is a senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University School of Law, and also an associate professor at the Southern Illinois University School of Law. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here and turn it over to Professor Schultz to talk about the topic. So Professor Schultz, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. I'm pleased that my center, the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University Law School, could co-sponsor this teleforum on this important topic. I think many on the call may be familiar, but to provide a general background of the topic, I'll speak in a few general terms, and then Professor Dolan will be able to give further background. The property rights and patented inventions are being struck down at an unprecedented rate in a new administrative forum, known as the Patent Trials and Appeals Board. The new procedures were instituted in late 2012 as a result of the America Invents Act. Many critics of the procedure have become quite concerned, because the board has invalidated the vast majority of the patent claims it has reviewed, and many critics have said that it appears the board's procedural and substantive rules appear to be tilted against patent owners. Judge Randall Rader, the former chief judge of the Federal Circuit, the nation's patent appeals court, has called the board a death squad for patents. In recent months, particularly, concerns have arisen that there have been some specific abuses of this system by hedge fund managers and other opportunists that we'll hear about from our speakers. And with that, I want to turn over the topic then to Professor Dolan, and he can provide some more background. I'll also note, though, that this is a very timely topic because reform of these procedures reforms are being considered in both the House and Senate as part of a broader patent law revision legislation currently being considered. The House, in fact, is the House Judiciary Committee, in fact, is marking up its bill today as we speak, and the Senate version of the legislation has gone to the floor of the Senate, and there is discussion about adding in further reforms of this process in the Senate. So I thank you for joining us, and I'd like to turn things over to Professor Dolan, who I'll introduce now. Professor Gregory Dolan is a professor at the University of Baltimore Law School, where he is co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law. Professor Dolan's primary research interests are at the intersection of patent and healthcare law. Before joining the University of Baltimore Law School, Professor Dolan has visited or taught at both George Washington University School of Law, as well as Northwestern University School of Law. He practiced as an intellectual property attorney, and he was a judicial clerk on both the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, as well as for Judge Pauline Newman of the Federal Circuit. He holds both a JD as well as a medical degree. And perhaps most important for this topic, Professor Dolan has written one of the early articles, law review articles, on this process. It recently appeared in 56 Boston College Law Review, 881. It's available on SSRN as well as the University of Baltimore's website. And he also authored a policy brief for the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property, my center at George Mason, that summarizes his empirical findings on this process. So with that, I'll give this give the microphone over to Professor Dolan. Thank you. Greg?
Thanks, Mark. Thank you, the Federal Society, for having me. It's always a pleasure to do one of these events, and this topic is indeed near and dear to my heart since I spent most of last year researching and writing on it. So, but let me just get right into just the meat of it. I want to begin with just a little bit of background. I wrote a lot of it in my paper, so I don't want to sort of spend too much time talking about the history of this reform. But I think a little bit of background, 30 seconds or so, is worth noting. If you were a person who got his or her patent news simply from reading newspaper, you could be excused for thinking that patent system was working just fine for the last 50 or 60 or so years until this new technology came along and terrible, terrible patent trolls started flooding the market with very vague patent claims, and that is why we need reform now, and that is why we need to really set the patent system back on the track that it used to be, on the straight and narrow that we used to have the last 50 years. Well, as it turns out, that is completely incorrect view of the history. Indeed, as I was writing my paper, I started pulling up the criticism of our patent system going back basically to the founding of the Republic. And other than for syntax, I can pull out almost any criticism from 1790s, 1830s, 1870s, 1910s, 1950s, 60s, 70s, all the way to 2000s, and I can interchange them between, and nobody would know the difference. Nobody would know that the exact same thing that is being said now was being said 100 years ago and 150 years ago and 80 years ago and so on. So the point of this is that the patent system was always under attack. There's no perfect system, and we've always attempted to reform in an attempt to get a better, more robust, and more definite patents out there. And that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But what is often lost in these debates about improving the patent system is the idea that additional benefits that are maybe conferred by additional procedures that may be created through new administrative or judicial or other means of reviewing patent applications also have corresponding costs. There is indeed, in patent system, just like everywhere else, no free lunch. And so the more we try to make sure that every patent issued is indeed really good and really valid, and that is, of course, an admirable goal. The invalid patents are indeed a bane of legitimate inventors. But the more screws we put to that system, the more likely we are to invalidate or not grant perfectly valid patents. So it really depends on how fine discrimination we have with respect to this process. So how many things we reject and how many we let stand. So with that understanding, with that sort of background, that we've been really on this attempt to really create a perfect system which does not exist for the last 150 years, I want to turn to what happened in Leahy-Smith American Invents Act. Congress was basically sold on this idea that patent system has really been overrun by these unscrupulous patent trolls who have these completely invalid patents, and the patent litigation is very costly, and we need a better system where we can resolve these disputes faster and cheaper and with more certainty for everyone involved, both the patentees and the public. The idea was that if we have this robust system with that experts look at these patents for the second time, we will have patentees whose patents will be reconfirmed will feel better because now they will have not just one stamp of approval from the patent office, but two. So they will know their patents are really, really valid. And the public would also know that, you know, invalid patents are fairly easy to get rid of. And on the surface, that sounds very plausible and actually doesn't sound like a bad idea. But that's not how it turned out. what happened, as I found in my research, is that instead of becoming a substitution for litigation, these new administrative procedures have become an adjunct to litigation. And so instead of reducing costs and producing more certainty, they've done exactly the opposite. They have increased costs, and they have reduced certainty. And here's how. For example, in a new proceeding called IPR, Inter-Parties Review, a challenger can file a challenge to a patent by asserting that the patent is invalid on the grounds of lack of novelty or obviousness. The problem with that, of course, there may be other categories of invalidity. And so even if the patentee wins, saying, no, my patent is not obvious and it is novel, and he actually manages to win in these proceedings, which is a problem in and of itself, which I'll get to in a second, that doesn't preclude the same challenger from then turning around, going right back into court and saying, right, but there may be also other grounds for invalidity, such as you didn't provide sufficient written description, or you didn't properly enable the patent, or you may have committed fraud in the patent office, or all the other reasons why the patent might be invalid. So instead of having a single system where all the claims get resolved, you may end up with having two systems. It also has increased costs because, unlike Article III courts, this particular system, administrative system, has no standing requirements. So I can be sitting at home doing whatever, you know, just because I'm bored, if I have a sufficient amount of money, I can file IPR requests, whereas I wouldn't be able to go to court. So that increases costs. And it, of course, decreases certainty because IPRs Patent and Trademark Office, their board, is not bound by prior court decisions that may have upheld this very same patent. They use different standards of proof and different types of claim construction, meaning that even if you've managed to prevail in court, even if you managed to get a judgment after a jury trial and appeal to the Federal Circuit, you may still lose your patent in these administrative procedures. So no certainty, higher costs, longer process. And in the last minute or so that I have left, I want to point out that not only has this act failed to achieve any of its goals, it actually created a whole new avenue for abuses. Because of this lack of standing requirement and the high probability that patentee will lose, so the current rate of loss is about 80 to 90%, depending on who's counting and which time frame you look at. Because of that probability of loss, the number of people have realized that they can basically blackmail patentees into either lower settlement amounts or just pure money transfers. So there was one case that I wanted to flag, and then I'll turn the microphone over back to Mark, where a company, patentee, sued Apple and won a very large judgment against them to the tune of about $300 million. It was a jury judgment. It was affirmed by the trial judge, and while that appeal in the Federal Circuit was pending, a totally unknown, newly formed company that nobody has ever heard of before, approached the patentee and said, give us 10% of your winning, or we will file an IPR request against you. It was not clear who this company is, why they should get 10% of the winning, but that was basically a request. Give us $30 million, or we will file an IPR request against you. That extortion demand was rejected, and lo and behold, IPR request was indeed filed against the patentee. And because the market is not stupid, the market knows how difficult it is for the patentee to prevail in these administrative proceedings, the stock market price of the patentee stock market price dropped precipitously. So what that allowed the challenger to do is basically being a win-win situation. Either they were going to get paid off by that $30 million, or they got paid off by shorting the stock right before filing the IPR. And so while the patentee was, of course, in a lose-lose situation, they either had to part with $30 million, or they had to suffer the loss of their market capitalization. And there's nothing that can be done about these types of pernicious requests. Because, again, there's absolutely no standard requirements. Anybody can file those IPRs. And if you have enough money, you can make a whole bunch more money simply by playing the market and destroying the value of legitimate patentees. So with that, I'll turn it over back to Mark, but I'll certainly be happy to answer more questions and provide more examples about equally bad behavior in these proceedings.
Thank you, Greg. Now I'll be introducing Mr. Robert Stern. Mr. Stern is a director at Stern, Kessler, Goldstein, and Fox, a leading intellectual property firm. Mr. Stern is one of the leading patent attorneys in the United States in patent reexamination and concurrent patent litigation, both in the federal courts and the United States International Trade Commission. He's recognized by his peers as a thought leader on board of director responsibility and best practices concerning intellectual property. He specializes in the area of intellectual property for cutting-edge technologies in the electronics, computer, communications, biomedical, and nanotech areas, the monetization of patents, patent litigation, and patent licensing. With respect to reexamination, Mr. Stern is a leading author and speaker on the topic of reexamination. He is the editor-in-chief of the leading treatise on this topic. The book is called Patent Office Litigation, a two-volume set focused on the new contested proceedings under the AIA, published in 2012 by Thomson Reuters. He's also the author of the ABA's chapter on reexamination and its treatise on patent litigation. In his position as a leading speaker, he is able to collect a lot of information and viewpoints on this topic, and we're grateful for the expertise he brings to this discussion. Also, further note that his position as a leader on this topic and a leader in the bar is important and quite admired. I was at a meeting recently where Mr. Stern was not in attendance, but a couple of the attendees noted that Mr. Stern not only has an extremely active practice in this field, but he instead of simply practicing, he chooses to speak out, to lead, and to educate about the topic and to advocate in matters of public policy, which truly sets him out as a leading attorney and somebody we can all be grateful to for his thoughtful leadership on this topic. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rob. Thank you, Rob.
Well, thank you all, and it's a great pleasure to be on this discussion today. I am always amazed by the law of unintended consequences when it comes to legislation. I was very involved with Joe Mittal and others on the Senate staff when the new AIA was being considered, and it was based on an article that I had written that was in its 11th edition for the Sedona Conference on the predecessor reexamination process. And when they were considering what Professor Dolan calls the inter-party review, the covered business method review, and the post-grant review processes, I was asked to make some suggestions on what could be done. And what we have now seen, and I made some predictions in the first chapter of the Patent Office litigation book, what we now see is quite a bit different than I think anybody expected. Faster, cheaper, and better was the contemplated goal. It was supposed to be faster, cheaper, and better to consider the issue of patent validity or patentability of the claims at the PTO rather than in the courts and at the ITC, and then let that administrative tribunal take care of it very quickly, and then we'll get back to the real issue at hand, which is infringement and damages and possible injunctive relief. In addition, it was contemplated that these proceedings would be very few in number, relatively speaking. They put a cap of 400 per year for the first 4 years. We now are running at the rate of about 2,000 a year, which is about five times larger than the maximum that was contemplated under the law, and the PTO has not exercised its right to limit the number coming in. And of course, we have, as we'll talk about more later, this whole new specter of short selling, where a short seller can literally game the stock of a patent owner by merely filing one of these proceedings. So let me focus my very limited time on a couple key topics for everybody to understand. The claims rules that are used in these proceedings are different than they are in the courts. They're typically broader. They use the broadest reasonable interpretation. The argument for that is that you are essentially able to amend your claims in these proceedings, when in fact we've only had one or two examples of amendment of claims that has been allowed. So that possibility, which was in the statute, does not seem to have come to reality in the real world. The Patent Office argues that attorneys are not properly taking advantage of that opportunity, but I can tell you that most attorneys would totally disagree with that and say that the ability to amend really does not exist in these new proceedings, and hence the basis, or one of the main bases, for this different claim construction rule is in fact not present. In court, validity, of course, is tested under the clear and convincing evidence standard, and in this proceedings, it's under the preponderance of the evidence. So claims are much more susceptible to being found unpatentable in these new proceedings. The statistics show that there's probably a two-thirds probability that the claims will be found unpatentable in these proceedings. If an IPR is involved, and if one of these covered business method proceedings is utilized with a computer-related invention involving financial products and services, the chances of success for the patent owner are probably less than 10%. So the other argument that was used for these new proceedings was that they were going to be used to weed out bad patents. Well, what seems to be the new normal, and this is based on a lot of research I've done recently with Thomson Reuters in the form of 50 webinars that involved the top speakers and top experts in the field, as well as a conference on April 23, where Professor Mossoff from George Mason University was on the faculty in Palo Alto. Based on all of that research, it seems that the new normal is that every patent in patent litigation today that's valuable, regardless of the merits of the attack, is going to be subjected to an IPR or perhaps an IPR and a CBM, depending on the technology involved. There is legislation being contemplated in Congress to change the claim construction rule, to claim change the burden of proof, and to do other things concerning discovery in these proceedings, which is a lot more limited for the patent owner than it is in the district court. And that would maybe make it more of a level playing field and make it more in sync with the results obtained in the district court when the same evidence involving the same claim is evaluated on the same issues. So there's a lot of concern in the patent owner community that this process is fundamentally unfair. On the other side of the coin, the falsely accused infringers, as I often say in speeches, would tell you that it's about time. It's about time that this process was created. Patent Office issued far too many patents in the late 90s, for example, that should have never been issued, and they shouldn't be dragged through the entire district court process and subjected to a huge amount of attorney's fees to survive that experience. If the proposed loser pays legislation is passed, however, it could literally make the ownership of a patent a liability and not an asset. Here's how. If you own a patent, as Professor Dolan pointed out earlier, you can be subjected to one of these proceedings regardless of whether you've accused the party bringing the proceeding of infringement. So you could easily see that if loser pays legislation applies to the IPR and the other PTAB processes, a patent owner, like a university or a small company or an individual inventor, could be dragged into a proceeding and not only have to defend their patent, but if they did defend their patent, which is extremely expensive, maybe $1 million per IPR through all the way through appeal, they could have the double whammy if they lose that proceeding of having to pay the attorney's fees of the challenger, which, as Professor Dolan points out, does not have to be accused of infringement. So you can see that the level of abuses could go up dramatically. In addition, the patent owner, and this is my final thought, the patent owner has to win everything in this new world. They have to win the IPR process first, and then if they win that after they go through appeal at the Federal Circuit, which typically takes 3 years, they got to go back to district court, which is probably another 4 years, which means that the trial is 2 years, and that subsequent appeal to the Federal Circuit a second time is another 2 years. So you have a situation where you could go through 7 years now to enforce your patent through 2 appeals to the Federal Circuit. You can imagine the financial risk to a small company or a university under the new loser pays, because not only could they go through this 7-year process, but they could ultimately have to pay the attorney's fees of the accused infringer. So it's a dramatic change in the patent landscape. We've seen a big drop in patent licensing. People don't seem to be settling cases anymore. Congress, as you all probably know, is feverishly at work trying to figure out what new legislation will pass. And what I always warn everyone is, regardless of how carefully you draft legislation, you must assume unintended consequences, as we've seen with this new process. So I'll turn this back over, and thanks again for the opportunity to be part of this.
Rob, thank you so much. Next up, we have Peter Sakala. He's the Vice President of Intellectual Property and the Chief Patent Counsel of the Celgene Corporation. Mr. Sakala is the Chief Patent Counsel at Celgene. His legal practice has focused on all aspects of pharmaceutical and biotech intellectual property law. He has extensive experience in patent litigation, prosecution, product lifecycle management, R&D collaborations, and joint ventures in the pharma biotech industry. He has particular expertise with respect to Hatch-Waxman Paragraph 4 litigation, as well as substantial experience with patent and regulatory litigation in Europe. He's regularly participated in due diligence investigations, patent, trademark, and copyright licensing, as well as M&A transactions. In addition, he has over 10 years of experience as a medicinal chemist and has worked in drug development programs for several major pharmaceutical companies and universities. Mr. Sakala is able to tell us directly from the industry point of view what their recent experience has been with respect to the effects of this this process. And I'm happy to turn it over to him. Peter?
Thank you, Professor Schultz, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. I'd like to echo the sentiments of Professor Dolan and Mr. Stern, and in particular, would like to highlight an example of the unintended consequences that both gentlemen spoke about. I think if anyone is looking for specific examples of the unintended consequences that the AIA brought about, one need only look at the pharmaceutical and biotech industry. These, in particular, the IPR challenges have and are wreaking havoc with regard to most pharmaceutical and biotech companies' business models. You may be aware that we are in a very high-risk business. Research programs are extraordinarily expensive. They are planned out over literally decades because it takes very long to get an approval. The uncertainty that the IPR process has brought about, which I'll get into in a second, has really caused most pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies to look at their programs and ask themselves, will we ever be able to recoup our investment if our patent portfolio is attacked and there wouldn't be a patent portfolio to protect any particular product once it has gone through the arduous review, FDA review and approval process. What we're seeing in particular are some IPR challengers who have no real interest in our business. They're not in the pharmaceutical business. or hedge fund managers, et cetera, who are filing patent challenges with the hopes of effectuating the stock movement in the capital markets, and hopefully, I would assume, by shorting the stock, make some sort of profit that way. We're also seeing sort of a subset of challengers who are simply extorting money from us. We're getting contacted. Other companies are as well. And essentially, we're being told, write us a very large check or we'll file an IPR. Surely, the AIA, and in particular, the inter-party review process could not have been developed with this sort of activity in mind. I'll also bring your attention to the fact that prior to the AIA, the pharmaceutical business essentially operated around the Hatch-Waxman Act, and it still does. The Hatch-Waxman Act is the pathway for generic drug companies to enter the market. It is also the process under which branded pharmaceutical companies are allowed to protect the generic challenge. Over the 30-some years that the Hatch-Waxman Act has been in effect, it has come to be something that lends stability and certainty to both the generic business and the pharmaceutical business, branded pharmaceutical business. It is a very finely tuned statute with very delicate economics. Unfortunately, though, the AIA, and in particular the IPR process, has turned the Hatch-Waxman Act on its ear, frankly, and it has brought about an enormous amount of uncertainty in our business, which makes it very hard for a small company to get started, to raise capital. It makes it very hard for an existing company to continue any particular program that it may be spending and investing in. And it has really, unfortunately, caused us a tremendous amount of uncertainty. I'm sure a lot of small startup pharmaceutical and biotech companies may think twice about actually going into business, which is a shame because in the United States, those small companies actually employ a lot of people. And furthermore, perhaps more importantly, they're responsible for developing lots of innovative life-saving drugs. And unfortunately, the AIA, in particular the IPR process as we know it today, has really turned the entire business on its ear. I think that my hope is that Congress will adjust the statute and at least introduce some elements of standing, some elements of claim amendment, and other things that mitigate the challenge, which truly, as Judge Rader called it, the challenge results in the patentee facing a death squad, a patent death squad. So that's what I have from the pharmaceutical industry. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Peter. Would any of you like to comment further on what you've heard your fellow panelists say? I'll start with Greg.
Yeah. Mark, if I may, I want to sort of just follow up on the last comments, specifically direct to pharmaceutical industries. As I said in my remarks, that there are other examples of abuses, and so one of them specifically comes to mind that also sort of highlighted in my paper, where it's not just these fly-by-night companies that simply play in the stock market, but companies that actually, in some sense, legitimate companies, but that use the IPR proceedings simply as a pressure or retaliation tool. So, for example, the one case that I highlighted in my paper is a case of three pharma biotech companies, One is of this large, well-known company called Genentech that is, you know, manufacturing things, is producing things. Another one is a smaller company that operates somewhat more of a startup, not quite, but they don't really manufacture. They invent, and then they partner up with companies like Genentech to produce, and then a third company. And so Genentech and this second sort of smaller company, they had a very amicable relationship. They were working jointly on a biotech product. Everything was going, in some sense, peachy until this third company showed up. So Genentech was licensing a patent that the smaller company had. No qualms about the patent. Genentech didn't think this patent was invalid or anything like that. Until the third company showed up and tried to get Genentech to license their patent as well, Genentech refused, thought that that particular patent was not relevant to them or not particularly good, or for whatever reason refused to license. And so the third company, as a method of retaliation, turned around and not just sued Genentech for infringement, but they filed an IPR against basically a completely innocent bystander simply to punish Genentech for not taking a license to their patent. So again, it's just an example of now requiring this company that was spending its money on research to not spend money on lawyers to defend the patent that nobody who would have been ever sued or asked to take a license was ever challenged. So complete bystander coming up and sort of forcing a company to spend its money instead of on research that ultimately will help the public on litigation. And in essence, increasing fees, making the system more clogged, less responsive to actual disputes, and ultimately creating these very unintended consequences that Rob talked about.
Thanks. Rob, do you have anything to add?
Well, for historical perspective, and this was in my Sedona paper, and it's also in the book and in the ABA chapter, this issue of short selling and stock drop price due to the filing of one of these post-grant proceedings is not new. This was going on in the early 2000s in the new inter-party re-exam, the predecessor to the inter-party review in the electronics industry against companies such as Tessera and Rambus and others, small companies with market caps, very sensitive to a challenge like a re-exam. And it's not just limited to the pharmaceutical industry. What's ironic to some is that the pharmaceutical industry, when the AIA was being considered, did not think that these new contested proceedings were going to be used against them, and instead were going to be used by the electronics industry for against patent trolls, whatever they are. And so this has come as a big surprise. What we see now in the short selling arena with pharmaceutical companies has come as a big surprise for many of the people that were involved in the fundamental lobbying and drafting of the AIA. The final thought to consider that I wanted to raise is that there is a one-year bar under Section 315B of the law that says that a defendant in one of these lawsuits must bring a IPR within 1 year of service of the complaint in the parallel litigation. This new lack of standing requirement has generated a whole new business model of companies whose sole model is to get subscribers to subscribe to a service that attacks the patents of a patent owner and avoids the liability of the one-year bar and also the estoppels that attach if you bring one of these proceedings. And we also see short sellers acting in concert at some level with other parties that have been sued through the filing of these IPRs using the short selling proceeds to fund the activities. So there's a lot of collusion going on in the financial markets using these new procedures. It's not just limited to the area of pharmaceuticals.
Thanks. And Peter, any further comments?
No. I actually agree with everything that's been said previously, and I do think that the one element that has really brought us some concern is the lack of standing. If there were one element of the IPR process that I think is the most that lends itself to the most abuse, it is the fact that anyone can challenge a patent without having any real nexus to the patent that they're challenging or the industry that patent may be participating in. So that's what I have.
Okay. Thank you. At this point, I'm going to ask one follow-up question, but just to give our listeners time to prepare to ask questions if they'd like to. And Christian, can you tell them how to do that, please?
Sure. Well, for those of you who'd like to ask a question, in a moment you will hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So in just a second, we'll hear the prompt. So again, to get in line to ask a question, press star and the pound key, and then while we're waiting for the callers to ask questions, Professor Schultz?
Yes, thanks. So I hear a lot of bad things about this procedure, and very few good. But to the extent I hear it defended, some people say, well, these are early problems, and we need to simply work our way through the system, give it some time to settle. We'll see, you know, we'll see some equilibrium reached that we can live with, or Congress can tweak it a bit, and it just needs some simple tweaking. So I guess the first question I'll ask is, do any of you agree with that premise, or do you dispute it? The second question I'll ask, I guess, is on the other side. What I hear sounds pretty bad, and I'm wondering, at what level of bad is it? This is a big picture question, but some of what I'm hearing sounds like patents are really being devalued to the point where companies may need to second guess them as business assets, and maybe it's possible you might tell a young aspiring attorney that the patent law doesn't have a bright future 5-10 years down the road. And we still have a lot of patents to challenge right now, but people still want to get patents. So let me ask our panelists if they'd like to address those two points. Just essentially, they revolve around how bad is this, really?
Well, let me try to go first. I mean, I think the answer, and, you know, I suppose people who are in the trenches may have a slightly different perspective, but I think the answer really depends in some sense on your perspective. Look, I think it's a good thing that when we have patents that are really should never been granted, when we clear, you know, when we do actually manage to separate wheat from chaff, and that these patents that have been, you know, and there really are bad actors out there. Now, not every company that doesn't actually manufacture is a patent troll and a bad actor, but there really are some out there, and to the extent we can tighten the screws on them, that's actually a good thing. That means legitimate companies, legitimate inventors won't have to waste time and money on legal help and could instead concentrate on, on inventing and making things for the public. The problem is, as I said before, is that every time you make it harder to get a patent for those people, you also make it harder to get a patent for everybody else. And it's all a question of balance. And what I fear is that Congress is really right now in this anti-patent crusade where they only see the benefits. And like I said, there are real benefits to having fewer invalid or fewer questionable patents out there. But they only see the benefits. They don't see the costs. They don't think long-term. They think, oh, well, my customer or my constituent was sued and, you know, got this terrible demand letter, which identified nothing in particular, doesn't really tell them what patent number is being asserted against them, and just basically is extortionate letter asking them for money, and that's terrible. We've got to do something about it. But they don't think, well, what's going to happen 10 or 20 years down the line when companies like Genentech and like their partners have to spend, instead of plowing another $5, $10 million into research, have to plow it to pay attorneys. So not to take any money away from attorneys. I know we have a bunch of them on the call, and they need to make a living too. But it's, you know, it may not necessarily be the best and most productive use of money. So there are benefits to this system. There certainly are. But I think it really has the pendulum has swung too far. It just needs to be recorrected so that we can have a second look, but without ability to abuse the system as it is being currently abused.
Thanks, Greg. Any comments, Rob or Peter?
Well, this is Rob Stern. I would say that our research has shown that licensing has really ground to a halt. And unless you're a very large company with a huge market cap and a lot of cash, your ability to get infringers to settle in any meaningful way is pretty much gone. And I don't think people realize, and I just did a series of I just held a panel on Capitol Hill on Monday about this issue. I don't think people understand the venture capital community's sudden understanding of the threat that this poses to the innovation marketplace in the United States. Traditionally, a lot of the major breakthroughs were done by small companies and universities. And these IPRs and PGRs, based on our interviews, are a real drag on investment in that area. If loser pay legislation comes in on top of this, what we've been told by many, many entrepreneurs who are serial entrepreneurs, very successful, is that the next wave of innovation is going to be curtailed by small companies. And the venture capital community is now, you may have seen some editorials in major newspapers on this subject, the venture capital community is now starting to raise a lot of big, big, deep concerns about the combination of this system with this proposed loser pay system. So innovation in the United States is at a crossroads by small to medium-sized companies and universities, and we really need to be very, very concerned about that. There's no doubt that there are some really bad patents out there that need to be taken off the public rolls that should not be allowed to be enforced in the courts, but people are questioning whether we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater with the changes over the last several years.
Thanks, Rob. Peter?
Yes, I think that if the question really is how bad is this, I would say it's very bad, and you need only look at the startup incubator type companies, those who are very dependent on their intellectual property for raising money and progressing their programs. I am sure, and I see it every day in my practice, that these small companies have a valuation that is much lower than it would have been 5 years ago, let's say, and predominantly because of the uncertainty brought about through the patent system these days.
Thanks, Peter. Christian, do we have some callers' questions?
We actually don't at this time, and we've got, I guess we have about 10 minutes left. Oh, wait, well, that was good timing. It looks like we had two questions that jumped on, so we can go right to them.
Great.
David Emerson is a society member here in Berkeley, California, and a patent attorney for more than 20 years. Many of the comments have had to do with the unintended consequences of the IPR under the AIA. And my question to the panelists is that although these consequences and, you know, what's been called abuses may have been unintended, there's certainly, at least to people who have practiced in the area for years, they're not unexpected. In fact, many of these were apparent very early on in the process that actors are going to act in their economic interest, and there's going to be behavior, not necessarily desired behavior, but unintended behavior, which will arise. So my question really is has to sort of go to, you know, what are your thoughts on what the failure of the process was, the political process, the lobbying process, that allowed this type of a sort of malformed AIA to come into existence, and you know, give us the problems we're seeing today, and what your thoughts are in terms of a political process going forward that would have a more beneficial result.
Well,
this
is Rob Stern. John Vesci, formerly of Rockstar, spoke to this issue when we had the panel discussion on the Hill on Tuesday, and his point was that the attorneys working for the big companies in particular have a fiduciary responsibility to their corporation to pay the least amount of money to others. I mean, that's the reality of it all. And the patent owners need to be able to rely on a system that's predictable, that is certain in many respects, that they can base business models on, that they can base investment decisions on, and that they can share with their shareholders so shareholders can make informed, predictable business decisions about investing in these companies. All of that has been upset by the current environment, and if the new legislation comes in, it's going to take years for the dust to settle. And his point is that if you had a criminal justice system, for example, where you did not know what the judge and the jury were going to do and what the rules were, you couldn't really effectively defend a defendant, regardless of their guilt or innocence, with any predictability. So what seems to be going on is that a lot of members of Congress do not really understand the subject fully. And so what's going to happen, whether we like it or not, is if legislation passes, it's going to have all kinds of issues that are not going to be contemplated when it's promulgated. We have a political system now that's very polarized on this subject, big tech versus pharma versus little tech, et cetera. And, you know, a lot of people are very concerned that any legislation passed in this environment is going to be very unpredictable and disruptive to everyone. So I don't really have a solution other than Congress does not seem to want to understand this fully and seems to want to rush this through.
This is Greg Dolan. I also want to add the observation that patentees, even in areas where kind of everybody agrees that patents are important, such as in pharma, have really unfortunately been somewhat politically outgunned. And while it's completely unfair and sort of just shows lack of understanding in just how the markets and venture capitalism works, I think what has made an impact, again, unwarranted impact, in a lot of politicians and certainly in a public discourse, is this idea that a lot of patents are held by companies. A lot of patents that are, for example, held by big pharma are not the ones that necessarily were developed in-house. And so the idea that goes around is that, look, there's companies that sort of gobble up patents. They don't actually create anything themselves. They simply just buy up patents. And therefore, the logic goes, we don't need patents to promote creativity because the companies that actually produce drugs, they're not the creative ones. Of course, it totally ignores how the world works, you know, that there's this division of labor. There are companies that concentrate on invention, and there are other companies that concentrate, they're more suited to production, and so on and so on. But that, I think, has created this misperception in the eyes of the public that patents are simply out there to make bigger companies bigger still, richer companies richer still, and so the true inventors are kind of getting shortchanged by the process because their patents get sort of gobbled up by giants, while giants themselves don't really need patents to produce the whatever that they produce, and they are no longer inventive. Patents don't drive invention anymore. I think it's a completely wrong logical chain, but I think that is the logical chain that has been sort of gaining currency. There was, for example, recently a paper by Mark Lemley that sort of went down that path, suggesting that after patent settlements, there's no technology transfer, and that has gotten a lot of play in the media. And I think that's a sort of, that's a political problem in terms of how do you sell it, how do you explain to people, to congressmen, to the public, that it's not necessarily a one-step process where everything happens in one shop. You invent, you get a patent, you produce. That there's a whole chain of companies that are involved in every stage of the process, and they work cooperatively.
Thanks, Greg. Any comments, Peter?
No, actually, that was very well put. I just assumed save time for the one last question that we might have.
Sure. So, yeah, we've had somebody waiting patiently. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
All right.
I heard at a recent lecture that although the IPR procedure was mostly a death penalty for patents, early on the difference has been in between patents that were defended and patents that were not defended, where the patentee simply gave up, and that the success rate for defending patents was much higher than those that were undefended, although that's a huge expense on the client. Does anyone have any facts that would affirm or contradict that?
Rob, go ahead. I mean, I think you...
Can you give me the question again, please?
The more recent results in the IPR, in the inter-party review, seem to indicate that when the patentee actually defends his patent in the inter-party review, the results are much more favorable to the patentee, that it's not a death penalty for those patents. Does anyone have any numbers on that?
Well, let me say that I believe the PTO stats show that about two-thirds of the patent owners file the patent owner preliminary response before the institution decision for trial is made. And that number seems to be going up percentage-wise because it's a very important filing, frankly, for the patent owner to defend. But the institution rate is still very high. It's about 70%. And once institution occurs, the overall average is about two-thirds of those claims that are instituted for trial are found to be unpatentable. So there's various ways to calculate it, but regardless, there's more than a 50% chance that a claim that is challenged in one of these proceedings is going to go down. So I think that a vigorous defense by the patent owner with a strong expert and real expertise applied to the process is essential, and that definitely raises the probability of success for the patent owner. This is based on my experience having represented a lot of patent owners. I'm in over 70 of these proceedings myself as lead counsel. And so, yes, it is true that if the patent owner does a very good job, their chances of success go up. But if you go to the typical patent owner and they say, wait a second, you know, I got this patent, I relied on this patent, I paid my maintenance fees, and more than 50% of the time, the averages say that my claim's going down, that can't be right. What kind of business could manufacture a product where 50% or more of the time it's defective? So it depends on which side of the V you're on. This is very almost religious argument with many people. I've seen people part ways professionally on this subject. I'm on both sides of it, and I can tell you it's very contentious amongst the practitioners as well as amongst the players.
Well, thank you. And it looks like we're coming up on the end of our time. And so I want to thank our participants, and I really appreciate it. This has been a useful and enlightening discussion, and I appreciate you lending your expertise to it. So thank you to Greg and Rob and Peter for agreeing to participate, and thank you to the audience for your questions and interest. And with that, I'll turn it over to Christian to take it out.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Professor Schultz and the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property as well as all of our audience and the rest of the participants for joining us today. And just a quick reminder that you can find the recording of this podcast or this telephone call as a podcast on our website, as well as the recordings of all our other previous telephone conference calls on this topic and 14 other practice groups on our website at fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.